This is Iconic.
Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things gumshoe. I'm your host, Jam, and with me as always are Becca and Mark.
Hello.
Howdy.
We have a great episode for you tonight. We are going to be recording the second half of our look at Swords of the Serpentine, a sword and sorcery role-playing game set in the city of Eversink by Pelgrane Press using the gumshoe system. If you go back and listen to our last three episodes, we've been talking about the player side of the Swords of the Serpentine, and that only got us about halfway through the rule book. Now we're going to cover what's there for the GM. So if, again, our goal here is not to provide every little bit of detail and information because we want you to go out and buy the book. Our goal here is to give you enough information to make a educated choice about going out to buy this book. And again, this is probably the nicest gumshoe book that I own. Like, it's beautiful. It's full color throughout the way, all the way through. Chapters change color as they move through, so you can always kind of see where you're at in the book. And again, all of this for, you know, $60. And that may seem like a lot, but if you think about it, you are getting a 380-page rule book, but it's all in one. You have all the character creation rules. You have all the actual game rules, the adversaries, magic, a very detailed setting, and a ton of great GM advice and an adventure, all in 300 pages. Again, it's pretty amazing to me how much they pack into this. So we're going to jump right into this. The first thing we're going to talk about tonight is the adversaries. Now, what I like about adversaries is, right, really in Trail of Cthulhu, you had things that might rough you up, and then everything from the Cthulhu mythos, which would, you know, eat your face. We got tonight's Black Agents, and we had a ton of great human adversaries, and then all of the mystical vampire-ish nonsense. Vampiric nonsense? Vampiric nonsense. But because this is based off of the great sword and sorcery novels and genres, Conan, Farfadet and the Greymouser, the Gentleman Bastards, kind of Black Company, we talked a lot about these. We need things that fill basically two roles. Humanoids, the people you're going to meet in the city, who are part of the conspiracies and the great factions. And monstrosities, the horrors that tend to represent a specific type of corruption or a specific overflow of human excess. And that's what we're talking about. So they actually don't just give you the monsters. They give you all of the tools to build your own. And that goes on for, you know, several pages. They give you templates. They give you special abilities. So before we get into malice and special abilities, what did you guys think of the chapter on adversaries?
I really enjoyed just kind of all the basic information. They give you how to build an adversary before they even give you their adversaries that are already built and made. And just reading through like how you build one, then when you look at one that's already created, it's just kind of easier to see what they were thinking, what they want from this adversary and why they created it. Because you already get, okay, I know it's an easy mook because of the threshold in health. I know it's an incredibly difficult one because it also has malice and this, that, and the other. So it was really nice to get kind of the background information before looking at the stat blocks, because it just gave me more to help me understand.
Right. They explained what, as you said, they just explain how to build a monster. So when you actually get to the monsters, you're like, oh, this is how this all went together. I know better what I'm looking at.
Yeah. And I liked it because there are some non-human threats, but being sword and sorcery, which we'll talk about more later, really a lot of what you're going to face are fellow humans.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to scale up, and instead of giving you a list of, okay, here's a guardsman, here's a magistrate, again, using the adjective, what do you want out of your bad guy? Here's how you can build it to be special and different than someone else you might meet on the street. And I like that. It allows you to set it very easily, come up with different kinds of foes. And you can use it for the monsters too.
Oh, yeah. Now, Becca brought up malice. And malice is a general ability that only certain creatures have. These creatures are going to be your threats. No, actually, I think everybody has malice to a different degree. This is the wildcard ability that it stands in for everything that's not on the stat block. So you can spend an adversary's malice for any general ability. So if they don't have it, if theirs is dry, you can use malice to keep things moving along. You can use it to increase a attack bonus. Like if you're making an attack roll, you can use malice to hit harder. You can also spend malice when you want to score a critical hit. You can spend 3 points of malice to give an adversary an investigative ability or a temporary investigative pool, which is actually really cool. Like because as Mark said, most of the things you're going to be fighting are humans. There's this idea of conspiracy, counter-conspiracy, plot, counter-plot, heist, counter, you know, defense against the heist. So I love the idea of being able to go, okay, Becca and Mark snuck into the thing. I'm going to spend some of this guy's malice. And he notices, hey, we've left that window open. Let's go check on that. It gives you an in-game currency, like all meta currencies. It gives you a reason to spend something to get the intended dramatic effect. You can also use malice to trigger special abilities, other maneuvers. It's just a great flex all ability that keeps the stat box small and tight. That's something we like about Pelgrane Press's games that we have played and reviewed. 13th Age, the stat box, the actual stat blocks are very small, very tight, very descriptive, and easy to understand and use. Same with the Gumshoe system. And Kevin and Emily did a great job of adapting Gumshoe to, again, a more action-oriented, but not in the same way that Knights Black Agents is action-oriented. The other thing they do is they give you a ton. I didn't even count, and I'm not going to now. They give you a lot of special abilities to slap on and use for your adversaries to make them stand out. Because one of the things about a pool system like this is it can very easily feel like, all right, this guy's just got a sack of pools that I need to poke holes in until they all drain out and then I win. And yes, as a GM, we can describe things great, but still it amounts to taking points out of the guy's pool pack and tossing them on the ground. Special abilities. But it lets you do it new interesting things.
Yeah, there's 43 special abilities that you can throw in on top of the malice as just a little, you know, icing on the cake.
So what was one of your favorites, Mark? Let's give some examples of cool.
I liked disguise because I like in this not just this genre, but in the Gumshoe system, the whole who do you trust, who do you not trust. And in this one, I like because it's the adversary can change your appearance and they can look, and it's either through illusion or makeup, whatever. It's just an ability. And then you kind of describe it. Is it because they have magic and illusionary, you know, I look like the bartender, or through makeup? And I like it just because it keeps the heroes on their toes, because you can easily use it for someone that they know and trust, and suddenly, how the person you're talking to is not the fence that you dent with before. And I like that, just to throw those little twists to the group.
What about you, Becca?
Similar to Mark, I thought the disguise was fascinating. But then there's a couple that if you combine, especially with human adversaries, it gives them a little that oddity, right? Lightning speed or spider climb. Things that you wouldn't necessarily see like a human being able to do. And if you did, it would make you question what else is at play. Like, is there possession? Is there some sort of corruption, sorcery? Or is that actually not a human and it's something else?
So my two favorite are in the first page. I love Bodyguard. I always love an ability where a NPC can interpose itself with the real NPC you want to keep alive for a little bit longer. So they spend malice and they take a hit. And I love Death Curse, where they spend the rest of their remaining malice when they die to curse the person who killed them. And so, of course, I come up with a little stat block for a set of bodyguards who take the hit and then curse the person who killed them, thereby ensuring that the person who hires them can get away. And plan on using that, if not in this game, definitely at some point in the future, because that's just a cool idea. There is a rich panoply of adversaries, both human and monstrous. The more I do behind the screen, the more I'm like comfortable just wheeling out weird things. So what were your guys' favorites? I'm going to start with mine. My favorite thing was one of the monstrous, the faceless. I love doppelgangers. I think a good doppelganger can be a wonderful dramatic twist, a poignant betrayal. And the faceless here's, I love that. I mean, this plays off the special ability you guys both love, the disguise ability. These things are terrifying. And it is rumored that they actually have to take the skin of the victim they want to wear, which just adds a whole other layer of disturbing body horror to these monsters. So, Becca, what about you? What was your favorite creature from this chapter?
I do think it's funny that you mentioned the faceless, because as I was like skimming through the chapter and starting to like look at especially the monstrous, there's so many human adversaries on even just humans to interact with. Stat blocks for just about everything that you could think of interacting with when it comes to who lives in Eversink. But I had to laugh because I was like, ooh, the buzzing acolyte looks creepy. Like, a giant fly in priestly robes, right? And then I, you know, skim down a couple and there's the faceless. And I'm like, okay, cool. It's getting even creepier. And you just keep going through it. And I felt like each subsequent thing was just kind of more traumatizing. The Penangalan is just a traumatizing picture. This, I don't even know how to, it's a cursed woman who can fly through the air with her stomach and entrails dangling from her. Like,
yeah, the head pops off and the stomach and entrails go flying.
It's a classic.
And I just kind of was like, it gets worse the further in the book you go. For a player, for a GM, it just gets better the further in you go. So that one was traumatizing. The shadow demon? I would use it as a GM and be like traumatized as a player. If that makes sense.
Yeah, that does. I feel like Winged Ape is also just a just a great homage. There's a Conan story with Winged Apes, correct? Yeah. What about you, Mark? What really popped in this chapter for you?
So to go along with my special ability, what I like, very similar to your faceless, and it's the one right before it, and it's the drowned.
Oh, yeah.
Anyone will tell you that the drown is a ridiculous conspiracy, that rumors aren't true. Often the person telling you this is already a member of the drowned. So they're drowned and they're part of this hive colony, but they look like normal people and they insert themselves into places of power to further the hive mind. So I think that would just be horrible to understand that the city council member you're talking to is a member of the drowned, as they send you off to do missions and you don't realize you're helping the drowned and not the city itself. Mm-hmm. That would be horrible.
Yeah. I hats off to both Kevin and Emily for this bestiary. It is top notch. There's a lot of art throughout this, like good art densities. So you always get a good picture of what is going on there. You get a little quote. I mean, I feel like someone at Pelgrane set the standard for everyone, all of their layouts, because it feels very much to me like a 13th Age layout. You got the name, you got a little bit of descriptive text, and then you get the stat block. We're doing an episode with the designers of this game and the writers, Kevin and Emily. We will be bringing them onto the show. We're going to hang out. We're going to chat about Swords of the Serpentine and just pick their brains. So if you have questions for us, please send them to iconicpodcast@gmail.com. We'll be glad to ask them or put them on the Iconic Patreon, because we have a Discord there. So you can jump on the Discord and say, hey, I have this question about Gumshoe. I'd love to ask it of the designers, and we'll recognize you and pass it on to them. So that covers our look at Chapter 7, which is the adversary chapter. Mark, chapter 8 is filled with GM advice. And again, for what they get into 25 pages, walk us through this. What do we have here in this GM chapter?
So the first thing they talk about is setting the tone for sword and sorcery. And some of you might wonder, what exactly is sword and sorcery? There's kind of one phrase, and they talk about it, but if you've read Conan or a fan of the movies, it's Mighty Thews.
Yes.
Big muscular barbarian who can do lots of things. It's very human-centric. If you read any of those kind, Fafford and Greymouse or that one, there are some, you could say, paranormal or just something that's not human as a threat, but they're not orc hordes or goblins or any of that. You don't have that in there. So it's human-centric. Your adventures are episodic and not always chronological. If you've read any of those books, they don't like start book one, book two, book three. It'll jump back and forth in his life. One, he's the young thief. The next, he's the king of Aquilonia, that kind of a thing. Heroes, even if it's not their motivation, because it's usually preservation, getting rich, getting to the next day kind of a thing, but their actions will change the world. So that's in sword and sorcery.
Mm-hmm.
And unlike any of the D&D versions or a lot of the other fantasy games, the hero, their ability is more important than the gear. Mm-hmm. You're not going to find magic swords that they keep for their whole life. Conan goes through, I don't know how many different kind of weapons and armor, adapting to wherever he was at, but he was always successful because it was him, mm-hmm. his abilities that overcame the adversaries. You know, it doesn't matter if it was a winged ape, giant snake, sorcerer. And speaking of that, sorcery is rare. And it's very dangerous, which in Eversink it is.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to get corruption, and corruption is illegal. It's highly illegal. They will hunt you if they know you're causing corruption. The world is hard. It's not easy. It's just the way it is, but you still strive to get better. I mean, that's why you go and plunge the depth of those ruins and mm-hmm. face the dangers, is to get a sack full of gold so you can throw a party and become poor and have to go do it all over again.
Right. And that's another thing, right? The fact that money comes and goes very easily, even in a modern sword and sorcery game or book like The Lies of Loch Lomora, The Gentleman Bastards, they lose everything between each book. Each book starts with them planning their next big score.
Yeah, or you steal something so rare it's great, but we can't fence it because everyone knows then that we stole it. So it's more of, well, we did it. What are we going to do now? Well, mm-hmm. okay, let's go do this. So we have some money to eat and drink. Villains linger, and that's why I like the subterfuge, and I think that's why Jam likes the Faceless and the Bodyguard, is the villains linger and their plans linger, so they should get away. Maybe not every time, but you're not just going to go chase the villain, kill it, and okay, that's done. The villain will get away. The bodyguards will take it, curse you, in Jam's world. And they're going to continue on and continue their plans. And the other thing is, it's always an ancient world with lots of crumbling ruins, and you discover ancient civilizations that were there eons ago, and you discover their secrets, and, you know, a millennia ago, there was Kingdom of Snake Men, and you're discovering these hidden ruins in the jungle. It's just, I could go on and on. Sword and sorcery is a fantastic genre. If you haven't read into any of those, read some Howard and Liza Lockamore and some of these others. They're pretty good. I like them. The big part, players help build the world, and they suggest that in this, when, and this really helps the GMs. I don't know how many times people ask a question, you're like, I haven't planned for that. Here they kind of tell you, throw it back on the players. When you're just like, hey, they ask you a question, you're like, well, you tell me, how tall is that building? Who is in it? I mean, what's the room look like? And play it from there. Let it go.
Especially when you're lucky enough, like in my groups, where I think our Wednesday night group, out of the, I've got four other GMs at the table. But also, and we talked a little bit about this on the Torg, the new Delphi Council debriefings will be going live on the Ulysses International channel here sometime soon. We talked about this. Sometimes if you are vague, your players are going to fill in what they need to. And pushing it back on your players just makes it so much easier on you to keep the story rolling.
That helps.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, as a GM that plays, I don't want to give you any information. You tell me. I'm here to play. I've done enough world building.
That's right. They also, this is interesting to me, they give us a page, just over a page, of advice for character creation. GM advice for character creation to help guide the players as they're building characters. I don't know that I've actually ever seen advice like this in a game. And I think what's nice about it is it helps answer some of the questions that can lead to analysis paralysis in characters. How do I pick investigative abilities? Which is better, health or morale? How do I specialize? They give you what gear do I get? They kind of walk you through each step and say, hey, as the GM, here's things you might want to point out to the players, especially if it's their first time playing the game. Becca, any thoughts on these first two sections before we go jumping into how to adjudicate investigative abilities in a sword and sorcery game?
These first two sections here in chapter, you said 8?
Yes.
Yeah, chapter 8. I appreciate them, and they are very they're very much in the vein of Pelgrane. If you've ever played their 13th Age game, it is all about the collaboration between the player and the GM. And I find that really nice in games, because a lot of times as a player, you kind of know what you want to add to the story. And as GM, as you had said, it is nice to get assistance sometimes with what is going on. And I like that they have a section of like, hey, as a GM, when you see your players making characters, here's something to think about. And if they do this, this is what you can use or how you can bring it and wrap it into your own game and ideas. So, yeah.
You've played some Gumshoe. Mark's currently running a Knights Black Agents game. You ran a little Gumshoe. What stood out to you for this customizing investigative abilities or adjudicating them section?
What I liked was just the fact that it asks the GM to use their common sense. Hopefully you have some. Just the idea of like, instead of, you know, thinking, oh, that's unrealistic or that's improbable, start with that idea, that question of, could a hero in a sword and sorcery story accomplish this? Because a lot of times heroes are able to go above and beyond what a typical human can do. And so getting that like in your brain of just like, okay, they are the hero. How does that change then what I'm going to allow them to do or not to do? And then just kind of gives you some reasonable effects for this point spends and talking about what are limits, because limits are good, but you know what's even better? Consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, like, how to put this? Like, I guess, like, for them, they say, you know, failure is boring. Consequences are interesting. And so instead of just saying, well, you failed, too bad, so sad, it's their whole mentality of failing forward and going, okay, here's a moderate success, but here's what happens as a result. And it leads to more conflict for your players.
Well, and one of the great things about, if you like Gumshoe, I highly recommend picking up Swords of the Serpentine, even if you're never planning on running it. Because Kevin and Emily really understand how Gumshoe works, which is not a surprise. Kevin ended up writing those. If you go back to the beginning of season 6, where we covered the Gumshoe 101, 102, you know, documents, Kevin wrote those. He broke down how to play and how to run Gumshoe. So we get a ton of great designer's notes. We get a ton of great ways on how to customize the Swords of the Serpentine for your play style, for your style of story, for your group. I'm not going to go through all of that because it's a masterclass in how to run Gumshoe. We'll probably have some questions for Kevin and Emily specifically about that. We'll be back next time to wrap up our look of the Swords of the Serpentine rulebook for Gumshoe by Pelgrane Press. And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by becoming a patron at patreon.com/iconicpodcast. You've been listening to the Iconic Podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, you can contact us at iconicpodcast@gmail.com. Also, check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and more information about the show. Thanks for listening.